Hi, everyone. I'm Amna Nawaz, national correspondent at the PBS NewsHour. Before tonight's show starts, I wanted to highlight our latest original podcast series, Broken Justice. It's about the fundamental right we all have to a lawyer, even if we can't afford one, and how the public defender system, meant to protect us, allowed one man to be sentenced to life in prison for a crime he says he didn't commit. Broken Justice is available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
On this edition for Saturday, January 4th, foreign policy fallout over the killing of Iranian military leader Qasem Soleimani, wildfires rage out of control in Australia, and a special series this weekend exploring climate change along the Mississippi River. Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Bernard and Irene Schwartz, Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Rosalind P. Walter, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
When it comes to wireless, Consumer Cellular gives its customers the choice. Our no-contract plans give you as much or as little talk, text, and data as you want. And our U.S.-based customer service team is on hand to help. To learn more, go to consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you. From the Tisch WNET studios at Lincoln Center in New York, Hari Srinivasan.
Good evening and thanks for joining us. Thousands of people marched through the streets of Baghdad today in a funeral procession for Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, and an Iraqi military commander, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, who were killed in a U.S. airstrike early yesterday. There were chants of vengeance is coming and death to America as mourners, including Iraq's prime minister, followed the coffins of the two military leaders through Iraq's capital. The coffins were later moved to the Shiite holy city of Karbala. In Tehran, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani visited Soleimani's family to pay respects and said his killing would, quote, not be forgotten in the history of U.S. crimes.
Americans do not realize what a big mistake they have made. They will see the consequences of their mistake, not only today, but in the years to come.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo defended President Trump's decision to kill the Iranian general.
They were aiming to take down significant amounts of Americans that would have undoubtedly killed locals too, Iraqis, Lebanese, Syrians perhaps, people all throughout the region. This was an attack that would have been at some scale. We can't talk much about the details, but suffice it to say the American people can know that the decision that President Trump made to take Qasem Soleimani down saved American lives.
Iraq's parliament is expected to convene an emergency session tomorrow to discuss the presence of the nearly 5,000 U.S. military troops in the country. For analysis and perspective on the U.S. strikes and Iran's reaction, we turn to Douglas Olivan, former director for Iraq at the National Security Council in the Bush and Obama administrations. He joins us now from Washington, D.C. So we are at some point expecting maybe a layout of the evidence, the smoking gun, on what was the preemptive move that we did, what justified it. I mean, he's been around for a while. Why now?
I'm not expecting any evidence to be laid out. I suspect that this was largely just about what Qasem Soleimani's been doing forever. He is the head of the organization that runs Iran's proxy network throughout the region, Hezbollah in Lebanon most notably, but also assistance in Syria, in Yemen, in Iraq. That's been his portfolio, and we decided to put a dent in that.
Most Americans don't understand how integrated Iran's influence is in Iraq at the moment, and that it's already compromised some of the U.S. military's ability to do what they want. Kind of break that down for us. How did Iran gain all this influence?
First, Iran's right next door. You know, Iran and Iraq have been neighbors for thousands of years. That said, some of us think that we're in this escalatory period because their influence was starting to be pushed back, that the protests that have been going on, not to be confused with the protesters at the U.S. Embassy, who were just disguised militia men, but the protests that are really going on in downtown Baghdad, which are pro-democracy, pro-accountability, anti-corruption, and largely anti-Iranian, had shifted the political winds in Baghdad enough that the Iranians were about to lose the ability to influence the selection of the prime minister. And we think that may be what started this whole escalatory cycle, starting with the killing of the U.S. contractor on the base near Kirkuk, and then the tit-for-tat that followed from that.
Okay, so the U.S. is sending more troops into the region. Where does this leave Iraq now, who are trying this balancing act? They want to be nice to their neighbor of thousands of years, Tehran, and also Washington.
Well, the troops are going forward to Kuwait. We don't know that any are actually going to go forward in Iraq, I think, except for a few that are going to relieve the Marines at the U.S. Embassy and have a slightly larger presence inside what is, by diplomatic agreement, U.S. sovereign soil. So we should have a status quo. The thing to watch in the coming weeks is, will there be political will in Iraq to reject the U.S. troop presence, the training mission, the anti-ISIS fight that has been there since they were invited back in the late summer of 2014? But if that goes away, if those troops are asked by the Iraqis to leave, then we're in a very different situation. So that's the indicator to watch most closely.
Does Iran have to respond? You can't just let such a high-profile leader be assassinated or killed without pushing back in some way.
One would think that for their own domestic political purposes, if nothing else, they're going to have to do some type of face-saving measure. I mean, the most escalatory would be attacking U.S. troops inside Iraq. We're prepared for that, but that would be escalatory. But they have options inside Syria. They could, in theory, launch rockets at Israel from Lebanon. They could use their cyber weapons. They could attack Saudi Aramco. They could put mines in the Gulf again. They've got a long laundry list of options, and we'll just see what they choose to do and whether that is seen by the United States as a routine face-saving measure that can be absorbed, or whether that is in turn going to require another response.
All right. Douglas Ollivan, partner at Mantid International and former NSC director for Iraq. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Harry.
Temperatures rose to record levels across Australia today as wildfires that have killed 23 people continue to rage. The government warned the public that it is, quote, not safe to move while 3,600 firefighters remained on duty across the state of New South Wales. Speaking to reporters, Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison announced that 3,000 reservists are being called up to battle the wildfires.
The Governor-General signed off on the call-out of the Australian Defence Force Reserve to surge and bring every possible capability to bear by deploying Army Reserve Brigades to fire-affected communities across Australia.
The wildfires have scorched at least 12 million acres, destroyed more than 1,500 homes, and have devastated countless animal populations since September. For the latest on the aftermath of Qassem Soleimani's death, visit pbs.org/newshour. This weekend, we are bringing you a special series of stories examining how the changing climate is impacting states along the Mississippi River. Our reporters and producers spent the last month traveling to several states that border the Mississippi to explore not only the impact of climate change, but solutions for combating rising waters, environmental hazards, and disruption of commerce. We began where the Mississippi River does, in the state of Minnesota, where businesses in the north that rely on the cold are facing warmer winters. One such business is dog sledding. Kaomi Getz, a reporter for One Greater Minnesota, brings us the story from Twin Cities PBS. This series is part of our ongoing series, Peril and Promise, The Challenge of Climate Change, and is produced in partnership with Nexus Media News, a nonprofit news organization.
Welcome to the starting line wearing bib number 8 from Duluth.
Temperatures dipped to minus digits for the 35th annual John Bear Grease Dog Sled Marathon. At 300 miles, it's the longest dog sled race in the lower 48 states. Peter McClelland runs a dog sled adventure business in Ely. He was one of the 11 marathon competitors. He said it's a challenging course.
The main thing you're going to think about is just take it easy at the beginning. You could lose this race in the first run. You cannot win this race in the first run.
One of the mentors of the John Bear Grease Sled Dog Marathons, please welcome Peter McClellan.
After connecting with his dogs, it was McClellan's turn to start.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The mentor is now the competitor.
It seemed like a picture-perfect wintry postcard, but the bear grease is changing. Organizers had to shave off more than 70 miles from last year's course. It was also rerouted, all because of a continual trend, lack of snow.
He's out of here!
Climate change, I think it's coming. I think it's here probably. I'm not an official, but I think it's here, and it's definitely something that's going to affect our industry.
The changes are already being felt by those who make their living off winter. Paul Shirky came up to Ely decades ago and runs a dog sledding business.
We've kept our own little notes on our operating season since we started here 40 years ago. And we've seen our dog sled operating season diminish by something in the order of 20%. In our first several years, we were able to consistently, our first decade, we consistently dog sledded for about 116 or 120 days of winter. Now maybe just over 90 if we're lucky.
Losing a month or more is disaster for a four-month seasonal business. Many of the state's dog sledders are concentrated around Ely. Shirky estimates if they all go under, it'll be a loss of $1.5 million a year to the area economy. And that's a lot for a community that can't survive on summer tourism alone.
For those of us who've been here now for some decades and whose businesses have been dependent upon it, we've got a microscopic view of what's going down because we deal with it daily.
The wintry beauty is something to see, but the scientists agree winter in Minnesota is under siege.
The summertime temperature is going up, but mostly because it's going up at night. It's not going up during the day. When we look at winter, the wintertime temperature is going up both during the day and especially at night. And winter in general is warming about 10 times faster than summer in Minnesota over the last 5 decades or so.
He says it amounts to a warming of about 1 degree per decade, and that contributes to milder winters. But what about the recent polar vortex of 2019? Blumenfeld says we used to get a lot more of them, and they stuck around for weeks.
The fact that it has been 23 years since one like this happened is probably really strong evidence that the climate has changed and is changing.
We're seeing this sort of a environmental distress or an emotional anxiety.
Researchers are looking at how people are responding to climate change. In Duluth, cross-country skiers are often challenged with less snow.
One creative adaptation we've seen people do is turning to winter hiking, turning to fat tire bicycle riding. There's fat tire bike tracks all over the place here where people are getting out on a bike.
Beery says with the changes, there also comes a new anxiety. Loss of identity and even livelihood. Peter McClellan finished 7th in the bear grease. Now it's back to work, giving people a taste of winter's magic. But he says some years it's been a scramble.
One of the problems with this whole climate change and tourism, you get a good winter and it's off everyone's radar screen. And then we'll have two, three marginal winters in a row and it's all anyone's talking about.
McClellan loves what he does for a living. You have to, since there's little money in it. But it's a passion he knows he won't be able to pass on to his kids.
I'd love to be able to do that, but, you know, we are going to keep having winters. So, but are we going to have enough weeks of winter that you can have a business that's viable?
We don't think of it as a kind of winter tourism industry. To watch our interview with the Nature Conservancy's Joe Fargioni about the impact of climate change on the Mississippi River, visit facebook.com/newshour. We continue our series further down the Mississippi, where this past May, the river crested in Davenport, Iowa at record levels, overtopping flood walls and inundating parts of downtown. Davenport, the largest of the Quad Cities with about 100,000 people, is no stranger to flooding. The latest round has reignited a debate about how the city, the largest on the Mississippi without a permanent flood wall or levee system, should protect itself from future rising waters. NewsHour Weekend's Christopher Booker has the story.
Front Street Brewery first opened its doors in 1992.
Did you like the Raging River?
A year later, it introduced its Raging River IPA, a fermented reminder of the historic Midwestern floods of 1993. But tonight, this beer is being poured in recognition of a more recent battle with the Mississippi River.
Inside the main floor of the restaurant building, we had about 18 inches to 2 feet of water.
So in here, there was 2 feet
of water? Yeah, where we're sitting right now, there was about 2 feet of water.
Front Street's co-owner, Tim Baldwin, says the water came in a matter of minutes when a section of the temporary flood wall assembled to hold back a swollen Mississippi River slipped. The exact moment in late April was captured on a security camera.
We ran, of course, got some things we deemed important, and by the time we were done rounding all that up, we found ourselves in the back of our building in our parking lot standing in nearly crotch-deep water.
It was that fast?
It was that fast, yeah.
By the time the Mississippi crested, a few days after the breach, the river in Davenport was 22.7 feet, the highest level ever recorded, and more than 4 feet above what is considered the level of a major flood. And Front Street Brewery and more than 30 other businesses in downtown Davenport were directly affected.
Were you thinking it's done? The restaurant's finished?
No, I didn't think that the restaurant was finished because, you know, we know the history of this place, and we know that in 1993, the exact same thing happened. So it was, you know, okay, we'll just have to deal with it tomorrow.
Flooding has always been a part of Davenport, but things have changed. Of the city's 15 largest floods, 7 have been since 2008.
The increased frequency of floods, including this spring's breach, has reignited a debate about how Davenport should protect itself from the river.
There are people immediately when it happens that put up a wall.
Frank Klipsch is the mayor of Davenport.
We've had a long-term position in the community that we want to embrace the river and not try to fight it.
Davenport is the largest city on the Mississippi without a permanent flood wall or levee system. Rather than build a permanent barrier, the city invested in a temporary flood wall built from metal mesh containers filled with sand, called HESCOs. The city has also expanded green space by buying out low-lying properties, creating a buffer zone that is designed to flood and hold water as the river rises. Mayor Klipsch says it's a model that has served Davenport well.
When you have a record flood, it challenges you, and now it's a matter of trying to work through that, and how do we, in fact, continue to do a better and better job dealing with that temporary nature, but embracing the river overall.
In July, Mayor Klipsch formed a task force to study how the city should update its flood plan. It had representatives from federal agencies, including the Army Corps of Engineers and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, plus local officials and business owners, including Tim Baldwin.
This is Davenport's problem.
Yeah.
This is Bettendorf's problem. Their problem is mitigated with that wall.
Driving around the region, Baldwin showed me what some of Davenport's options may be.
You think about where our business is located on the river, this would be our view.
The town of Bettendorf sits right next to Davenport. It completed this permanent levee in 1987. It's estimated that a similar wall in Davenport, which is a much bigger city, would cost at least $175 million. But regardless of the cost, Baldwin doesn't want to see one in Davenport.
I certainly wouldn't want my customers to climb up on a levee to be able to take advantage of the river views. So sitting behind a wall like this just doesn't have the same appeal.
But Davenport will have to do something, especially if it wants to protect its low-lying downtown. And it's not alone. Increased flooding is an issue that communities up and down the Mississippi are dealing with.
Is climate change contributing to an increased number of floods?
Absolutely.
Definitively.
Definitively.
Larry Weber is an engineering professor at the University of Iowa and the co-founder of the Iowa Flood Center. It's an academic center created to help the state prepare and protect itself from floods.
We get a lot of rainfall in Iowa. As climate change has impacted our weather in Iowa, we don't get the right amount in the right time as much anymore. You know, we have this intensification of rainfall. You know, it's the rainfall event where we get 8 inches of rain, and then we get another 6-inch rain, and then another 10-inch rain, and then no rain for several weeks or months.
So flood, drought.
Yeah, that's right.
He says the increase has been noticeable for Iowans over the last quarter century.
In 1993, the general sense amongst many people throughout the Mississippi River was we had just experienced the flood of a lifetime. You know, we experienced the 500-year flood, and so we wouldn't expect to see an event like that again.
Lo and behold, though, we've seen many more 500-year floods.
Yeah, in 2008, people were surprised when the Iowa and Cedar River basins flooded again at levels that were equal to or much greater than 1993.
In June of 2008, Iowa experienced the largest natural disaster in its history when the Cedar River flooded Cedar Rapids, causing an estimated $5.4 billion in damages. More than 11 years later, the city is still recovering as it implements a $550 million flood protection plan, funded with federal, state, city, and private money. The plan includes levees, walls, and entire neighborhoods that were bought out and returned to green space. The cost and timeline of Cedar Rapids' recovery is not lost on officials in Davenport.
It takes that long to plan, and it takes that long to get the proper funding in place. So it's not a quick proposition, unfortunately.
Nicole Gleason is Davenport's Director of Public Works. She's responsible for implementing the city's flood plan, including the placement of temporary barriers.
Is it possible to balance these two ideas, the idea that you want to have an accessible riverfront and you also want to have a dry Davenport?
I think it is, but I think that it's going to have to be a balance of figuring out critical infrastructure, critical assets, and maybe looking at protecting those specifically, and then looking at other ways to turn those areas that are more difficult to protect or don't make as much sense into protect into more parkland, more wetlands, things like that.
But figuring out how to balance protecting different parts of Davenport's 9-mile riverfront and who should bear the cost could be a contentious process with so many stakeholders.
You start this battle between downtown business owners or those that live along the river and the rest of the taxpayers in the city of Davenport saying, you're the dummies that built down there or operate businesses down there or live down there. Why should we pay for this? And on the surface, you know, that's probably a natural reaction and probably some accuracy there. But you know, what people don't think about is that this flood mitigation is a problem for the entire city.
And Baldwin concedes that permanent flood protection for Davenport might mean retreating from the river.
You know, if the city and FEMA came in and said, this is what we need to do, we wouldn't have had a lot of pushback.
If they said, we need to buy your buildings and
buy your buildings and tear them down? I mean, certainly we'd want to be compensated appropriately, but you know, we wouldn't have pushed back on that because it seemed to be the right thing to do. There's other places we can operate from, right?
But for now, this pub remains on the riverfront, celebrating a grand reopening 7 months after it was flooded.
I would like to call this special city council meeting.
Meanwhile, Frank Klipsch's term as mayor just ended, but he says that the city's flood task force has identified several short-term priorities, including commissioning a comprehensive engineering study.
Has this changed the way that you think about climate change?
I think the reality of it is there's still, I have found there are some people that want no talk of how it's happening, but everyone can understand there's a new normal now and we've got to deal with it.
And officials note that this past fall was wetter than 2018. Not a good sign for keeping Davenport dry this year as the winter snow melts and the spring rains come.
This is PBS NewsHour Weekend, Saturday.
The end of the year is traditionally a time for charitable donations. In France, organizers of a charity raffle hope the possibility of winning an original Picasso will raise millions for clean drinking water projects in Africa.
The French nonprofit organization Help the Others is selling up to 200,000 tickets for a chance to win this 1921 Picasso still life. A 100 euro ticket, about $110, is all it will take to claim the painting valued at more than $1 million.
The idea was to have a raffle because everyone all over the world could participate. And we wanted to get money from everybody to raise money for a good cause. So I thought of a painting, and obviously Picasso is the most famous artist ever. So I thought Picasso would be a good choice.
On display in the Paris Picasso Museum, the abstract oil on canvas shows a table, newspapers, and a glass of absinthe. The small painting measures about 12 by 18 inches.
Nature Mort from 1921 is not a painting with a groundbreaking format, but it's magic because it's a painting of synthesis. And we have all this Picasso genius revealed in a very small size.
This year's Picasso comes from the collection of a Monaco billionaire. In a 2013 Picasso raffle, the group raised more than $4 million for charity.
You don't find a lot of paintings of Picasso at $1 million. It's quite rare. Usually the prices are much higher.
The raffle proceeds will go to the international charity CARE for a project providing clean water and sanitation facilities to schools and villages in Cameroon, Madagascar, and Morocco. The winner will be announced in Paris on Monday.
We'll have more on the impact of the changing climate on states along the Mississippi River tomorrow. As part of our special series, we'll look at changes in shipping traffic and the environmental threats from increased flooding. That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. Have a good night.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Bernard and Irene Schwartz, Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Rosalind P. Walter, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments. Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.